she scored high on measures of legal ability, impartiality, integrity, temperament, and diligence.
The Senate confirms an Alaskan to the federal bench. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, November 15th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new model for medical care is catching on in Alaska.
Made astronomical differences in the way that we practice and patient satisfaction.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
For the first time in state history, Alaska will soon have a female judge appointed to the federal bench. Judge Sharon Gleason was confirmed by the U.S. Senate today on a vote of 87-8. She'll take the job as U.S. District Court Judge that was left open when Judge John Sedgwick accepted the role of senior judge on the district court. Alaska senators both praised Gleason in speeches right before the vote. Senator Mark Begich said having a woman heading to the federal bench is a momentous point for Alaska and long overdue.
I know Sharon quite well, and I recommended her to the president for this opening. I can say without hesitation that she is one of Alaska's finest. She is smart, she's compassionate, well-rounded, and possesses an ample supply of common sense.
Senator Lisa Murkowski worked as an attorney in Anchorage, so is familiar with the legal community. She pointed to the praise of Gleason's fellow judges and commended her for her strong work ethic and fairness.
Sharon Gleason last stood for retention last year in 2010, and she scored high on measures of legal ability, impartiality, integrity, temperament, and diligence.
Murkowski encouraged her Senate colleagues to vote for Gleason's confirmation, but eight of her fellow Republicans voted no. The dissent came from conservatives, including Minority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, Florida Senator Marco Rubio, and Senator Jim DeMint of South Carolina. The same conservative bloc also voted against a California-based judge today who won confirmation anyway. Some Republicans are trying to hold up President Obama's judicial picks for courts around the country. Another Alaskan is waiting for her name to go before the Senate. Judge Morgan Christen, who has been nominated for a seat on the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. She can't take the job until the Senate confirms her. Christen is second in line on the Senate's docket for circuit judges nationwide, but there's no telling when they'll get to her vote. Sevs across the state are transforming the way they practice medicine. They're becoming medical homes. The idea is to do a better job treating chronic disease at the primary care level to keep patients from needing more specialized treatment. In pilot projects around the country, medical homes have improved care and trimmed costs significantly. And healthcare providers in Alaska are hoping to replicate that success. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
A few months ago, when patients called to make an appointment at the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Clinic, it took 4 weeks or more to get them in to see a doctor.
That's not ideal in any sense.
Phil Hess is the clinic's medical director. He says ANHC has whittled that wait time down to almost nothing. Better access to doctors is just one change that will make the clinic a medical home. ANHC is now in the early stages of the transition. Hess says the model harkens back to the old idea that everyone should have a family doctor they see on a regular basis. He says medical homes started popping up about a decade ago.
Primary care had kind of lost its identity in some ways. There was more and more specialization. More fragmented care as patients went from a specialist to the hospital, and a lot of people really hadn't had a primary care provider. So it was sort of this back to the future moment with family medicine.
That Back to the Future idea is also playing out at the Providence, Alaska Family Medicine Center in Anchorage. Dr. Ann Musser is leading the clinic's effort to become a medical home. She's dedicated one wall of her office to a giant whiteboard diagram mapping out the old system and the new one. Under the old model, a patient was seen by a doctor, sent out for labs, and given a prescription or two. Musser says there wasn't a lot of follow-up.
You're just kind of out there flapping in the wind and not really knowing what to do, the choices to make about foods, how to react to your blood sugar, what to do about a medicine that upsets your stomach, all of those kinds of things, you know, all those questions that patients have just kind of go unanswered until the next visit, which if it's 3 months away is just not appropriate.
As they move toward the new system, the Family Medicine Center is especially focused on trying to improve the health of patients in three categories: those who have high blood pressure, diabetes, or depression. Medical homes are supposed to be especially effective in treating those types of chronic diseases. Under the model, patients set their own goals for managing their health, and that's a big change for doctors like Musser, who are used to telling their patients what they should do.
It's tough. You know, I've been in practice for 25 years, and I have my style. And my patients are used to my style. And so this is a difficult transition, and it's been really a fun exercise in us as a group changing our behavior to help patients change their behavior.
Patients have surprised Musser by setting tough goals for themselves. Soon the clinic will have case managers to help doctors follow up on those goals. They'll also track the kinds of things that often fall through the cracks with chronically ill patients, like making sure lab work is completed. Those are the big changes the clinic still needs to make. But Musser says even some small changes have made a big difference for patients and staff.
Our phones used to be answered by this just horrible phone tree. You know, people would just start pushing buttons, you know, just to get out of the phone tree. So we changed that. And now the goal, at least, is that phones are answered in three rings by a live person and that there are no blind forwards, so you don't send it to somebody else's voicemail.
And Musser says staff members actually enjoy answering the phones these days because they can help patients by getting them in to see a provider quickly. The clinic's no-show rate for appointments has been cut in half. And she says overall, the positive impact from all of the smaller changes has been enormous.
Made astronomical differences in the way that we practice, and patient satisfaction, staff satisfaction, physician satisfaction, everybody really improved.
The ultimate goal of all this reform is better patient care, but it's also cheaper patient care. The idea is that good primary care will keep patients from needing more expensive specialists or emergency room visits. Many pilot projects have seen costs cut by 20% to 30% with the medical home model, and the state is now starting its own medical home pilot for Medicaid. Department of Health Commissioner Bill Struer says he doesn't think Alaska can see savings that big, but even more modest savings would make a huge difference.
If I could save 10%, I'd be very happy. I spend $1.5 billion on Medicaid. If I could save $150 million over a two-year time frame, I'd be very, very happy.
The state is going to start its experiment with four healthcare providers in rural and urban Alaska. Struer says he hopes to get as many people as possible enrolled. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The weekend cleanup. The cleanup continued in Sitka's Eliason Harbor today from a weekend storm that packed 60-mile-an-hour winds. Sitka Deputy Harbor Master Chuck Hackett says two boats sank in the storm, the 30-foot Dancing Girl and the 24-foot Lisa Nicole. Other problems included a vessel that broke free and beached, one that drug anchor, and several that experienced damage from collisions with the docks as they pitched and rolled with the unusual chop that moved through the harbor. Hackett says the Harbor Department went through about 300 feet of extra line in attempts to secure boats. But most impressive, he says, were the scores of people in the harbor who came to each other's aid.
You've got people that have boats on the inside are probably sitting in their own stalls, comfortable and surely getting rocked around, but nothing like the outside of Eliason Edge, where it's kind of a transient area and it seems to take the brunt of it. You know, boats get kind of smashed up against and their buoy balls get snapped and lines get broken, and there must have been 20 or 30 people in Eliason running around helping, assisting our staff, which, you know, we have a small staff. So there was five of us, plus search and rescue, Don Cluding and Gerald Gangle were assisting us, as well as just other people.
Attempts were made to raise the sunken vessels today. Hackett says most of the damage was to boats. He says the harbor itself experienced some chafing and a few snapped water lines, but nothing major. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Talkeetna residents go for the world record in the event of cup stacking.
I like how you get to stack up, stack down, and everybody can stack up and stack down.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
And by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
The Horizon Line shipyard in Unalaska shut down yesterday over worker concerns about potentially explosive refrigerated containers. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce has more.
Last week, the International Longshore and Warehouse Union notified members up and down the West Coast that some refrigerated containers, or reefers, passing through shipyards could be explosive. ILWU spokesperson Craig Merrilies says the coolant in some reefers was contaminated earlier this year during maintenance work in Vietnam.
And while nobody knows for sure what's happened, it appears that this cut-rate operation may have used some dangerous chemicals in the process, maybe introducing them into the compressors. And the result has been some serious explosions with some of the compressor units blowing up.
Horizon Lines is the local agent for Maersk, one of the affected shipping lines. In a press release issued last week, Maersk said the coolant in some of their refrigerated units had been linked to three separate explosions in 2011, all overseas. Maersk took more than 800 containers out of circulation as a precaution, but local union president Doug Leggett says longshoremen weren't satisfied with the response.
The union's position was that we wanted to isolate anything that had potentially been serviced in Vietnam, and I believe the employers initially wanted to only look at containers that had been at a particular facility over there.
Following the lead of workers in other West Coast ports, longshoremen in Unalaska refused to transport any Maersk reefers until Horizon provided maintenance records for the containers. Union officials met with company representatives during a closed-door meeting yesterday afternoon to resolve the issue. Leggett says they agreed to isolate any containers that had refrigerant service done in Vietnam during the last year.
That gave us the definition of what to look for, and we've been since then in the process of trying to identify these boxes and isolate them from the public and from ourselves, really, so that they eliminate the potential of having another incident.
According to Leggett, workers have identified approximately 60 at-risk containers in Unalaska and Accutane. Half of those belong to American President Lines, another container export company in town. According to spokesperson Mike Zampa, APL hasn't had any problems with its containers, but was cooperating with the union request as a precaution.
APL has grounded and isolated 34 refrigerated containers in Dutch Harbor, and these are containers that had undergone maintenance inspections in Vietnam during 2011.
Zampa says APL will review the container's service records before proceeding. Maersk representatives could not be reached for comment. Horizon Line's local terminal manager, Bruce McConnell, could only say that Horizon containers were not affected. The local Coast Guard Marine Safety Detachment says it's not investigating the situation. In Unalaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
A major maintenance project will replace aging pipe at Trans-Alaska Pipeline pump stations. The project targets old corroded piping, like the feeder line at Pump Station 1 that leaked, causing an extended mainline shutdown last January. Alaska Pipeline spokeswoman Michelle Egan says the failing pipe is the result of low oil throughput that's making it more susceptible to corrosion.
The lower flow means that there are parts of our piping system that are not used or that are underused, and so that allows material to build up in the pipe that could cause corrosion. So we have several projects either underway or in process that will replace those types of pipes.
Egan says some of the work was already planned, but other parts of the project are mandated by the Federal Department of Transportation as a result of last winter's Pump 1 incident. She says replacing underground piping is one of the focuses of the project.
That was part of the problem. During the January shutdown, we had some piping that was not in use or in low use. It was buried in concrete encasement, and so it was difficult for us to get to the pipe and deal with it. And so we had a project on the books to bring all that piping above ground where we can get to it, we can inspect it more closely, we can deal with any issues that come up.
Egan says Alyeska is trying to bypass as much of the suspect pipe as possible until the work can be completed. The pipe replacement will be happening at pump stations 1, 3, 4, 5, and 9. Egan says the new piping sections are being prefabricated to limit the amount of time the main line will have to be shut down. She says Alyeska will spend tens of millions of dollars over the next few years to complete the work. A Western conservation group wants endangered species protection for flying squirrels on southeast Alaska's Prince of Wales Island. The group says logging on Tongass National Forest land is a threat to the animal's survival. KFSK's Joe Vicknicki reports.
Wild Earth Guardians offices are in Colorado, Arizona, and New Mexico, but the group has focused one of its latest efforts on flying squirrels in southeast Alaska. The group is petitioning the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to list the population on Prince of Wales Island as endangered or threatened. Guardians Wildlife Program Director Mark Salvo says the small mammal is one of the most imperiled in the region.
This is a species that is threatened by current and future land uses. An endangered listing under the Endangered Species Act would help to direct and guide management of its habitat to ensure that the flying squirrel persists in the future.
The Prince of Wales population is a subspecies of the northern flying squirrel, and it has also been found on smaller islands around Prince of Wales. The creatures are nocturnal, and they feed on truffles and blueberries. They move through the forest by gliding from the top of trees up to 250 feet in one jump. Salvo says logging is a threat to the animal's habitat.
The latest planning documents leave much of the island's open to logging, setting aside only some small old-growth reserves of mostly low-volume, isolated forested areas. So this leads us to believe that this sensitive species, already identified by science as imperiled, will become further endangered by logging in the near future.
The group is also highlighting logging that's occurred at two narrow points of the island at Neck Lake and Sulcer Portage and says large open spaces make it difficult for the squirrels to move safely between areas of old-growth forest, their primary habitat. Scientists have studied squirrel numbers on portions of the island but don't have an overall population estimate or know about population trends. U.S. Forest Service's Brian Logan, a forest wildlife biologist on the Tongass, says it's difficult to count squirrel numbers.
What we typically do in situations where we have a species that's hard to sample like that, we will sample limited areas and then extrapolate from that. And we haven't actually done that specifically for Prince of Wales flying squirrel.
And Logan says the Forest Service's conservation strategy for the Tongass protects habitat for squirrels and other wildlife. That strategy centers around a network of reserves of old-growth forest, along with standards for development that is permitted on other land.
We do monitor the conservation strategy and its effectiveness, and at this point in time, we feel it's a valid strategy, and we're confident in the protections that it affords all species across the Tongass, including Prince of Wales flying squirrel.
The Wild Earth Guardians petition could lead to a status review for the animals. The petition review process, if it is funded, can take a couple of years. Fish and Wildlife this summer also received a petition to list the Alexander Archipelago wolf. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicknicki.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com. AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
The news has been full recently of stories about the huge storm that battered Alaska's west coast last week. While the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Sherman figured prominently in helping a nearly disabled catcher processing ship, those reports have few details. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander brings us the rest of the story of the Rebecca Irene.
The high-endurance ship has been on patrol in the Bering Sea for nearly 2 months. The worst weather was last week's storm.
We'd been watching it for a couple of days as it developed off the east side of Russia and began heading our way. And I knew I had about 12 hours before it was going to get bad. And we were north of Aimak Island and thought, yeah, it's about time for us to head to the southwest, probably towards Unalaska and tuck into Beaver Inlet.
Hester credits Captain Bark Lloyd of Station Juno for the tip about the relative calm of Beaver Inlet during a storm. But on Tuesday night, that wasn't to be.
The SAR call came in from district, and they told us about the Rebecca Irene, which had lost an engine.
As the Sherman headed toward the catcher processor, the problem became clearer.
They hadn't lost an engine. They were on the verge of losing the only engine they had.
The Rebecca Irene had 38 people on board, and the Sherman needed to evacuate most of them before the storm hit hard. The 378-foot cutter is powered by diesel and gas turbine engines. Hester says it was time to use the fuel-guzzling turbine and charge toward the ailing ship.
You know, the weather was chasing us right on our heels. And when we got there, conditions were already pretty bad.
The Sherman launched its helicopter and two small 23-foot rescue boats, and within an hour, 24 Rebecca Irene workers had been evacuated. Hester says it was just in the nick of time.
Last boat that came across reported to me that if we'd stayed in the water another 10, 15 minutes, they would have been very concerned. We were pushing the bounds on where I should be running those boats. They're limited to 30-knot winds and 8-foot seas, and both of those limits were being pressed by the time we got the last boat load off.
With relieved Rebecca Irene crew bedded down for the night in the Sherman's heated hangar, the cutter shadowed the nearly disabled ship into Dutch Harbor. Captain Hester says the overheating engine prevented the fishing boat from heading straight into the rough seas.
So they chose to sort of quarter them with their bow. That makes for a very unpleasant ride on a 378. And so instead of trying to parallel their course, we did a course upsea, downsea, about a mile offset from the Rebecca Irene.
He describes the winds as fierce, green water washing over the bow. It was certainly a challenge for the Sherman's new conning officers, responsible for maneuvering the ship.
And the key is to watch the sets of the seas and do the turn right after the biggest ones have passed.
Hester says he stepped out onto the bridge wing about 11 p.m. when the Sherman was running down sea, down swell.
And as the stern of the Sherman dipped into the trough, the top of the wave was above our aft stacks, you know, above the exhaust stacks. This is an enormous wave coming at us in the night.
But that was the worst of the night's winds, which whipped up seas that were well over 20 feet. The captain says his weather log shows winds tapering off, and by morning, white caps of only 3 to 4 feet.
Just as quickly as the Bering Sea can get snotty, it can calm down again, and the next day be a beautiful sunrise.
The Coast Guard cutter Sherman left Dutch Harbor on Saturday for the last month of patrol in the Bering Sea, with more sea stories to be gathered. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
Students at Talkeetna Elementary School are aiming to help set a world record tomorrow. KTNA's Lorian Nettleton has more.
Ready? Go!
The 5th and 6th graders in Karen Mannix's PE class at Talkeetna Elementary are divided into 3 circles of 6. They're stacking cups. Each student has 12 plastic cups, similar to the cups you might find at the state fair. These are speed stacking cups, and each kid is charged with building a pyramid with his or her cups as fast as they can, and then taking them back down again. One game has 2 players stacking against each other. It was happening so fast I couldn't quite tell what was going on, so I asked one student to explain what they were doing.
Blake Zimmerman, the basic game point of the game is to do a 3-6 stack. And so what you do is you go to one side and then go back and do it again. And then whoever does it first, you push the button and then it pops up and whoever gets knocked down loses. And then the person wins.
You got all that? Most of these kids have been stacking cups now for several years. They know how many different ways 12 cups can be stacked, whether making 4 pyramids of 3 cups each or 2 pyramids of 3 cups and 1 stack of 6 or 2 stacks of 6. If you want to get complicated, you could do one stack of 10 with two leftovers. To an adult who has never yet stacked cups, it looks incredibly complicated. But to the kids, it's structured fun.
I'm Kai Kingery. I like how you get to stack up, stack down, and everybody can stack up and stack down. I like working as a team because everybody gets to enjoy cup stacking.
Anya Schwartz. Well, it's just all about, like, we have lots of fun, and yeah, we just lots of fun.
My name is Parker Helton, and I'm doing cup stacking. It's just like free time. It's fun how you just express your feelings with cups, how you can stack it up.
The kids are practicing for participation in Wednesday's bid to set a record for most cups stacked worldwide. Karen Manick says they not only have a lot of fun stacking cups, but they're developing some important skills.
My primary objective is to teach kids to use both hands. I actually feel like when they stimulate themselves by movement and quick movement, they actually they're stimulating their brains. They actually can become more involved academically.
Not only are the kids running around stacking cups, changing places with a partner, doing push-ups in between cup stacking, but, Manick says, they're training their brains to cooperate between left and right hemispheres.
If kids can actually coordinate their eyes with both of their hands, then they're doing a lot of cross-brain kinds of activities, because typically movement is, I would say, bilateral in terms of brain power. You know, there's dominancy involved, and so if you can teach kids to use their non-dominant hand, especially with fine motor movements, it's really helpful to them. And, you know, there are all kinds of statistics about learning how to read, you know, doing things quickly with your hands, piano playing. I mean, there are lots of connections between fine motor hand movements and reading ability.
In addition to attempting to set a world record, the students of Talkeetna Elementary invite the public to bring in non-perishable food items. Any donations received will be stacked into a pyramid before being taken to the food bank. In Talkeetna, I'm Lorian Nettleton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Ronco in Sitka, Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Joe Vicnicki in Petersburg, Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, and Lorian Nettleton in Talkeetna. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company,
and by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.